This is John Howell Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Well, we've had plenty of wiretaps and now videos too. It's getting more and more interesting in the ComEd 4 trial. My next guest, Hannah Meisel, writes for Capital News Illinois. She's watched the entire trial, taking a day off today, obviously. She'll be back at it next week. So longtime ComEd lobbyist Jay Doherty thought he was merely reminiscing and giving advice to a colleague and a friend back in February of 2019. He was sitting there with the former ComEd executive Fidel Marquez, but alas, Mr. Marquez was not only wearing a wire, but he had a hidden camera too.
The city owes us $59 million or $74
million. Wow, was it that much?
Well, part was Park District,
okay.
Part of it was school,
okay.
Part of it was this, and it was a whole lot.
And
of
Mr. Marquez is by that time working for the feds because they had come knocking. Hello, 6 a.m., just like Blago. Feds always show up nice and early. And he decided to roll, give evidence. And he's been on the stand for most of this week, and my understanding he'll be back on the stand next week. Well, let's start there with Hannah Meisel, again, a terrific writer for CapitalNewsIllinois.com. So we had wiretaps and now videos, too. Hannah, thanks for your time on this Friday afternoon. What are the biggest takeaways from this past week?
Oh, wow. So the ex-executives from ComEd, who truly would have been, you know, in the defense box if it weren't for his plea deal with the government and his agreement way back in January of 2019 to cooperate with the government in their investigation of ComEd. Fidel Marquez, he's been on the stand since Monday, late morning, and he has endured about 20 hours of questioning so far, 15 hours from prosecutors, and then Wednesday and all day Thursday, cross-examination from the defense. It's been a very intense several days at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse this week. I'm grateful that Fridays are off, but we saw, you know, I think the very anticipated thing that we saw this week were the undercover videos that Marquez had made. I think, it was like 4 or 5 different videos, and they were made against, again, what would have been his co-defendants, John Hooker, Mike McClain, Jay Doherty, and they were very revealing. You know, it was after the government had kind of directed him to seek information, get these things on tape about the subcontractors that were under Jay Doherty, of course, the former president of the City Club of Chicago, longtime ComEd contract lobbyist, and the subcontractors were allies of the speakers, you know, from the 13th Ward, former Alderman Frank Olivo, two of, you know, Madigan's, you know, favorite precinct captains, and also former Chicago Alderman Mike Zaleski Sr., who was hired in 2018 after his exit from city council. Now, in that case, he was actually hired to do legitimate work to renegotiate the city franchise agreement with ComEd, but that never actually happened. And it seems that he actually didn't do any work either, you know, ended up getting paid anyway, which I should say is not unusual for lobbyists. They are, you brought in, as ComEd CEO Joe Dominguez said on the tapes, for a magic moment in which they are, you know, very valuable when they convince elected officials to vote a certain way.
Take us back to the beginning here. How did Marquez get ensnared by the feds initially?
Well, on a January morning at 6 a.m., two federal agents approached his mother's house in Chicago where he had been staying, and they played him some recordings. And when people in the house were waking up, they took him to a nearby strip mall and they talked in the parking lot for, you know, another, hour and a half. And in those 2 hours that they all spent together, he immediately agreed, without consulting lawyers, without consulting anyone in his family, to cooperate with the feds.
Whose phone was wiretapped that ensnared him?
Well, so Mike McClain's phone was wiretapped for, I believe, about 9 months in 2018, early 2019. you know, Marquez, McLean, they talked all the time. Of course, you know, in these phone calls, which this investigation traces all the way back to 2014, and, you know, the feds have confirmed that originally the target was just Madigan, and it has obviously spread out.
Yeah.
You know, very, very far-reaching effects.
Hannah Mizell is here from CapitalNewsIllinois.com. So he'll be on the stand Monday again. What can we expect next week?
Well, there is a little bit more of defense cross-examination from him, and then government will do their redirect. And they're going to, you know, defense has spent a lot of time this week trying to poke holes in the argument. And then also, you know, a very intense moment that came yesterday afternoon when attorney for McLean, Pat Cotter, you know, basically accused Marquez of saving his own skin because he would have been right there, as I said, with the other defendants.
So he's back on the stand next week. They'll finish up with him. And then what happens after they're done with Marquez?
Well, I'm not sure when the government is going to rest its case. I do know that at the outset of the trial, we heard that there was going to be 70 witnesses in the case so far. And, oh, gosh, I wish I would have counted beforehand, but I feel like we have heard definitely not from 70 so far. We have seen a lot of emails, though, and we've heard a lot of tape recordings. We know that we were, you know, set to hear about 100, and I don't know that we have gotten that high either yet.
Hannah, thanks so much for the update. We appreciate it. We'll read more next week at CapitalNewsIllinois.com. Have a terrific weekend.
All right. Thanks so much, John. Take care.
So that's why I don't want to do that. So I recommend nothing in writing.
I think all that can do is hurt you.
I recommend nothing in writing.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
Get news on the hour, the half, and when it breaks. Continuous coverage at WLSAM.com. I'm Kim Gordon, 890
Now let's welcome Frank Main, a terrific reporter for the Sun-Times, back to the program. Well, I guess, Frank, the differences are going to come down to defining exactly what is proactive policing and what are the root causes of crime. Right, Frank?
That is correct. It's kind of mirror images of each other in terms of strategy. It's hard to nail down either one of these candidates on what their specific public safety platforms would be, but I would agree with you that that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah, they have vastly different plans, but they don't elaborate very much on these plans. Let's take this by categories. You and your co-writer pointed out that things sometimes are a little worse than they seem, but in some ways, things are a little better than they used to be. Let's start with just statistically speaking, how bad is this year compared to the history as far as murder and shootings?
So last year there were something like 713 murders. It was a huge, huge increase over 2019, you know, 50% increase over 2019. The year before 2022 was even worse, and so we're seeing murder rates. We're seeing number of murders kind of ebbing right now, as opposed to last year. But again, we have a long, long way to go before we're back to 2015, 16, 17 rates of homicide. So it's still a major problem.
20 years ago, you wrote, about half of the murders in Chicago resulted in an arrest, and that rate has now fallen under 30%, and it's traveling south. So crime is way up, but arrests are down. That's a toxic combination, isn't it?
It is. I mean, so, you know, we've known for a while that homicide clearance rates were going down. That is, the number of arrests and murders was going down from, say, 2020 to era rates. And reason was that they had a lot more detectives then, and the state's attorney over the years has demanded a lot more evidence to secure a homicide or murder conviction. So there's that. But the more disturbing thing, I think, is the humongous slide of arrests in all other types of crimes. I mean, if you look at a chart that we put in our story today, I mean, it looks, you know, it just essentially went off the cliff over the last two decades. And so, you know, I mean, I'm looking at it now, 141,000 arrests in 2002, 26,000 arrests in 2022. So that's a 80% drop.
You would think, Frank, that it's a target-rich environment, right? With crimes are skyrocketing. Forget murder. Take that out of the equation. Just the other crimes we've talked about. If crime is up exponentially and arrests are down, it would seem to be a target-rich environment for the rank and file and detectives as well. Are police just demoralized and just not doing what they used to do?
That's part of it in terms of the number of arrests. You know, we're told by, you name whatever rank there is in the police department. You've talked to a police supervisor or a police officer, they'll say, you know, we are worried about violating department rules, winding up on TV for, you know, being blamed for an arrest that, you know, went bad. And so instead of engaging, Rahm Emanuel said it best, I guess. He said that the police had gone fetal after a series of reforms following the Laquan McDonald shooting. And so, I mean, that hasn't really changed that much, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years. I mean, police are still wary about engaging with the public, and they're worried about, you know, more and more that everybody's got video cameras, and, you know, they don't want to be
viral video. Yeah. Has Paul Vallis, has he elaborated on what it means to take the handcuffs off the police? I keep hearing that over and over and over.
Well, you know, he had said it earlier on, and this is one of the things he's kind of backpedaled on now. And in the last debate, he said, I wouldn't use that kind of rhetoric. So essentially what he's talking about is proactive policing, which is essentially making arrests. And he also says he would continue the reforms that are required under the consent decree. So this is one of those areas where we really don't know specifically, you know, what his plans would be. But, you know, essentially he's telling the public, look, I want police to make more arrests if and when I'm mayor. So,
yeah, we'll see. You know, devil's in the details. And finally, if arrests for violent crime is way, way down, why are traffic stops way, way up?
Superintendent Brown, about 2 years ago, decided that traffic stops were going to be the way that the police department was going to combat violent crime. And so there were about 500,000 traffic stops last year in Chicago, which is a ginormous increase over previous years. And the problem is, in most of these, we talked to officers about this too. And real quickly, what happens is that they have to write a report called a blue card every time they do a traffic stop. So there were commanders and supervisors telling these guys, we need 2 to 5 of these blue cards every single day. And they were doing so many of them that they couldn't even write tickets sometimes. They just give a warning and, you know, move on to the next one. Problem with that, of course, is in the neighborhoods where all this is happening, do you think the people that are getting stopped are going to be happy about the police department? It furthers the
disconnect
between the community and the police when you do that. People don't, you know, feel like they're being harassed.
Has Brandon Johnson elaborated on his policy, which essentially he told residents recently, you know, you have to invest in the community, stop the crimes, or stop the environment that promotes crime. Which would you prefer, to have your crime solved or your crime prevented? Has he elaborated on that? That seems like pie in the sky talk.
Well, it kind of is. I mean, you know, what he's focused on is funding social services that get at the root of the problems in disadvantaged neighborhoods where all this crime is. And that is a, a good, it would be a good thing to bring up those neighborhoods. So his plan is essentially to rely less on a law enforcement strategy and more on social services strategy.
Well, whoever wins, it's pretty apparent that policing in Chicago will be quote unquote evolving, right?
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see who the next superintendent is going to be, who kind of takes over this, difficult crime picture that Chicago has right now.
Well, Frank, thank you very much for your time. Frank Main, my compliments to your colleague, Tom Schubach. I encourage all my listeners to go take a look at all the data that's in this as well. It's terrific. Frank, thanks so much for your time. Have a good weekend.
Appreciate your having me, John. Thanks.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Former Navy SEAL Sean Ryan shares real stories from real people from all walks of life on The Sean Ryan Show. Comedian John Crist.
How long have you been in Nashville? Let's see, 2018 is when I moved here. I lived in an apartment. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in L.A.
You were living in L.A.? How was that?
Yeah. Well, let's see, good for my career. Sent me to rehab, though, so. That's pretty much the sum of it.
The Sean Ryan Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
It's always great to draw on the experience and expertise, intelligence of Royal Oaks, ABC News legal analyst based out in Los Angeles. Royal, thank you very much for your time on a busy Friday afternoon. I know you're stretched thin. Everybody needs to talk about the Trump indictment. First question, would that New York DA have brought these charges this late if it wasn't Donald J. Trump?
I think most people would say, no, it certainly wouldn't have happened. And they would point to the fact that the statute of limitations may well have passed. Trump has a shot at getting it tossed on that basis. Secondly, the predecessor DA in New York City, Cyrus Vance, not exactly a Republican, he passed on it. Plus, the Democrat-controlled Department of Justice refused to do it, as well as the Federal Election Commission. So, yeah, a lot of people are thinking that this George Soros-backed district attorney, Alvin Bragg, is simply trying to weaponize the legal system. The other side of the coin is Bragg is going to look squarely into the cameras and say, look, I really sincerely believe that this guy committed a felony, that he knew what he was doing. He lied about the fact that this was not legal expenses, as the records show. In fact, it was a Stormy Daniels check. And as a result, you know, I'm going to let the jury decide, and nobody is above the law. So you've got a healthy difference of opinion.
How can he reconcile a state misdemeanor with a federal campaign charge?
That's a great question. And people have been digging through the files. And so far, nobody has come up with a single example of a New York City DA ever doing this kind of thing, saying on the one hand, well, we get a state law misdemeanor and then bootstrapping it into a federal election law campaign violation that is a felony. Essentially, what the DA is doing is trying to read Donald Trump's mind and have evidence presented to the jury that Donald Trump did know exactly what he was doing. He knew he was given $130,000 to his campaign by giving it to Stormy to hush her up, helped his campaign, and he did it nonetheless, and thus he lied to the feds. So that's what the DA has to prove. Here's the problem, though. The key witness for the DA is Michael Cohen, who has been convicted of lying and other crimes, is a disgruntled ex-employee, and everybody knows he would give anything to put Donald Trump behind bars so that Trump could experience the same thing that this guy had. So if the jury believes Michael Cohen, then Trump could be in trouble, but he's not exactly the ideal star witness for the DA.
There's 34 different charges, apparently. Have we heard specifically what any of them are?
No, and we won't know until 2:15 Eastern on Tuesday when the arraignment occurs and the indictment is then unsealed for the world to see. And probably it's going to be a bunch of technical sections and subsections, all of which add up to essentially one argument, which is Trump committed the misdemeanor by falsifying Trump records, and then he committed the felony by lying to the feds. One problem the DA is going to have is that Trump is not exactly a hands-on guy. The likelihood of there being some evidence that Trump touched these records, influenced these records, it's pretty slim. And plus, it's hard to play the mind reader and decide that Trump's real motivation was help his campaign as opposed to simply do what every other guy on the planet would do, namely pay some money to make sure that the lady he had the assignation with goes away. Again, Michael Cohen is at the center of the debate.
Allegedly had that with.
Exactly.
Okay. So what makes a grand jury indictment different from others?
Well, a grand jury is just 23 folks who agree to spend several months of their life, basically a full-time job, listening to arguments by the district attorney and voting up or down should various people, including Donald Trump in this case, be forced to go to trial. And it's controversial because it's secret. The defense doesn't get to participate. No lawyers for the defense are in there. The alternative would be a public preliminary hearing, but the DA has the right to go in New York to the secret route. And these folks are now discharged. And unless the statute of limitations argument works or a plea bargain is cut, don't count on that. Then we're going to have 12 more people hearing this case, regular jurors, but good luck finding 12 people who haven't already made up their mind about how they feel about Donald Trump.
And he'll only need one, obviously, and it helps him politically.
Well, that's right, and that's the interesting calculus. He's got a right to a speedy trial, so he can move this thing along and have a trial probably this year if he wants. Will Donald Trump want that, or would he rather push the trial into the next year? A weird, interesting twist here is if it drags on and on, as some court cases do, you could bump up against the November 24 election, and then you're in a weird situation of maybe the guy will be elected again, and at the same time, he will be convicted. And there's no law that says he can't be an inmate and the president at the same time. The law only says if you are convicted of an espionage or insurrection offense, that would disqualify you. So now we're in the twilight zone. He's sitting in the joint. And what are they going to do? Have an oversized cell so that the Resolute desk moves in and the Secret Service moves in? They're like his roommates. And what if there's a prison riot? Do the guys get the nuclear codes and blow up China? I mean, people are going to go from Trump fatigue to Trump utter exhaustion, I think, is the plan for the Democrats. I think they want Trump to suck all the oxygen out of the room. No DeSantis, no Pence, no Nikki Haley. It's all about a wounded Trump. He rolls in and somehow wins the nomination. And then what do you know? Trump is the one man on the planet Biden can beat, because by then, you know, Biden's mental acuity might have diminished and Trump's already been beaten by Biden. A lot of people think that's the Democrat playbook.
Yeah, well, that's politics. But constitutionally, shouldn't we have sorted out this executive privilege issue during Watergate and the aftermath?
Yeah, that's a thorny issue. You know, the judges always have to have a balancing act. The courts acknowledge that advisors' statements to presidents should be secret. They should not have to reveal them. But courts have also said, if essentially what the advisor and the president were doing is seems like cooking up a crime, and if it isn't a national security issue, it's not like you're revealing the nuclear codes, the executive privilege argument goes out the window. It gets back again to the credibility of Michael Cohen. He was a fixer. He was at Donald Trump's right hand. But now he's a flawed witness because he's been convicted of lying, and he has a grudge against Trump, and so he's a disgruntled employee. People may take his testimony at this trial with a grain of salt, and if he's not believed, I don't think Alvin Bragg, the DA, has much of a chance to win against Donald Trump.
Independent DA or state's attorney doesn't have to answer to anybody except the voters of that particular district. But that being said, out of all these cases percolating, the one that seems, to my mind anyway, and I'm not a legal scholar like you are, Royal, but it seems like the obstruction of justice possibility with the documents, that's the strongest case. The rest is all very subjective, all the rest of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were scratching their heads and saying, gee, do you lead with your weakest case? Because arguably the Stormy Daniels deal is the least significant of the alleged offenses and the weakest case among the alleged offenses. You know, if you go to Washington, D.C., you might get a jury to say, yeah, Trump, he said go there peacefully, but really he incited a riot. If you go to Georgia, you might get a jury in Atlanta to say, yeah, he really tried to cheat and steal the Georgia election results, or the Mar-a-Lago deal. I wouldn't be surprised if more indictments are teed up by these other prosecutors I just mentioned in the next several months. And that may be, again, a part of the legal strategy to really have a pincer movement on Donald Trump. If he's facing two or three things at once. You know, a national survey recently said 57% of Americans think that anybody who's under indictment for a criminal offense really shouldn't be running for president. Well, if that is the attitude of the American public, with at least one indictment, you know, floating like a miasmic cloud above Donald Trump's head, he's going to have a hard time winning the election. And so, as you suggest, legal and political issues, they just seem to intersect tremendously in this controversy.
But I think it's safe to say, and a lot of my Trumpian listeners would say, there should never be collusion between independent state's attorneys, you know, Fulton County, or this guy in New York, or the independent investigator regarding the documents. There shouldn't be collusion between them. The, you know, justice is supposed to be blind.
Absolutely. They're supposed to be independent. And of course, even without collusion, maybe the other prosecutors are really cranky, because when you think about it, Alvin Bragg, by indicting Trump first,
yeah,
what has
That's
he
it.
Done? He's guaranteed yeah. his name will be in the history books until the sun explodes and engulfs the earth in flames. I mean, he is the man forever for anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, and he's part of the history books.
So this works for Trump and his core constituency. It works for Bragg and his core constituency.
Yeah, and the issue is, how is sort of the great middle, the 50% of Americans who, you know, don't always vote Democrat, don't always vote Republican, how are they going to react to this controversy? On the one hand, they may be exhausted about Trump. On the other hand, it's basic. You don't want to weaponize the legal system and punish your political enemies by using your power yeah. as a DA. And as the Republicans have said, what, is a red state DA now going to go after Hunter Biden? Is
yes.
that what we want in our country?
Well, that's what's going to happen. Royal Oaks, ABC News legal analyst, how are things in Los Angeles today? Are you still under a deluge, or have things cleared up?
Things are clearing up a little bit, but we did realize that there's actual weather in California after all. So you've known that for a long time in Chicago.
Well, the old song is, it never rains in Southern California.
Well, you can tear that one up, because the drought is over here. It's been very moist.
Royal, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
You bet. You too.
Take care.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
Let's talk food. It's that time of day. The James Beard Foundation named the finalists for the 2023 awards, which will take place here in Chicago, my understanding, on June 5th at the Lyric Opera. We've had him based here for several years. I read about this in my Chicago Tribune. Nick Kindlesberger. I love to talk food with Nick, especially late on a Friday. So, Nick, looking over the nominations here, these are the Oscars of the restaurant world, obviously. There's some pretty big surprises. Let's start there, such as?
So this year, in the Great Lakes category, there are chefs from cities other than Chicago. So the Great Lakes region for the James Beard Awards includes Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio. And Chicago has basically run the board with this category for the past 8 years. And so for this year, this one, actually, there are more chefs from Detroit than Chicago.
Hmm. Do you find that surprising, or is it kind of an evolution of the awards?
I think it's a good thing overall. You know, I think there are other great restaurants outside of Chicago. I, of course, am very biased to Chicago because I love it so much. Do I think that Detroit should have gotten 3 to Chicago's 2? Probably not, but I'm just so happy to see other cities getting some recognition, because I think this will help the whole region. We want to show that we have great food. And so this has been something that the James Beard Awards have talked about wanting to do, so they finally implemented it this year for sure.
How are the nominees determined? I mean, is it possible that Detroit's local restaurant association kind of stack the deck?
Well, the James Beard Award has a number of anonymous restaurant reviewers who go around and check on these things. So we don't know exactly how it was done this year. You know, there's some really interesting projects in Detroit, and so it's very cool to see. But, you know, the two that did make the cut on Chicago are two of my absolute favorite restaurants in the whole city. So, you know, we're still seeing a really high quality of Chicago talent out there. You know, Mi Tocaya in Logan Square is one of the finest Mexican restaurants that I've ever been to in the Midwest. And then Kasama is this phenomenal restaurant in Westtown area that pulls in a lot of influences from the Philippines. And so they're two of the most exciting restaurants in the country, I would say.
Nick Kindlesberger is here from the Chicago Tribune. The James Beard Award nominees have been announced or made public. How is it Chicago doesn't have a single nominee in the Outstanding Wine and Beverage Program category?
You know, these sort of things are difficult to figure out exactly what happened. You know, and if we win in years previously, then we're less likely to win the next year or the year after that. Yeah. I haven't done the research to see exactly if it was last year or the year before, but we've done very well in that category before. And then, you know, so I think they're really trying to spread the love around. It's not a scientific process, but we did get some big nominations this year. So we have Damar Brown, the chef de cuisine at Virtue, is a nominee in the emerging chef category. And then Sepia is up for outstanding hospitality. You know, that Sepia is a restaurant that's been open for a long time, and they've been consistently nailing the hospitality. So I'm so happy to hear that they got a nomination this year.
And we already know who won the Humanitarian of the Year award from the James Beard Association.
Yeah, they like to give a good shout out to the Humanitarian Award. And then also, let's see, what was the other one that they already announced? In a Lifetime Achievement Award. So the Humanitarian of the Year award is going to Olivia Watkins and Karen Washington. They started this thing called the Black Farmer Fund. So to help Black-owned farms. And then the Lifetime Achievement Award goes to Madhar Joffrey, who I have many of her cookbooks at home right now. She's an Indian cookbook author and has just been, you know, putting out astonishing cookbooks for the past 20 years.
And finally, I guess just up the road from us, one of the best new restaurants, you know, nominees for the best new restaurants in the Midwest region. What is this, Lupi and Iris in Milwaukee?
Yeah, you know, I haven't been there. Oh, and I did forget to mention that Obelix, which is in Chicago, is also up for Best New Restaurant. So that's a huge get right there. And I think Obelix is pretty outstanding. I reviewed them over the summer. They're sort of a French restaurant, but they have pulled in all these other influences, including Mexican and Vietnamese flavors that I think show, you know, how creative the chef there can be.
Before we let you go, since it's Friday afternoon, almost Friday evening, what restaurants would you recommend for this weekend, possibly here in town?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, I've been eating a lot of barbecue lately, so I think that people should try to get out to their local barbecue joint. That seems like the weather's getting nicer, you know? It's starting to feel a little like the spring air is here. So if you live by, you know, choose your own barbecue of choice, but so I really like Green Street Smoked Meats and Smoke Barbecue. It's pretty close to me. I'm going to have a big barbecue article coming out in the next couple weeks. So
excellent.
Stay tuned for that.
Excellent. I'm going to paraphrase a late great blues artist here in town, Big Twist. Is it ever possible to have too much barbecue?
I've tried. I've tested the limit, I think. I've had it for about 2 months straight. I've been out eating barbecue. So I still would eat some more. When you have great barbecue, it like you never want to stop. Like it just keeps going.
Nick, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend, sir.
You too. Thanks so much.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.